Me es grato dar la más cordial bienvenida al profesor Yuri Anatolievich Ovsinnikov, tanto en mi propio nombre como en el de la Fundación Juan March y en el de sus colegas y amigos españoles. España no es para Ovsinnikov un país extraño, ya que ha tenido la oportunidad de visitarla en varias ocasiones. De hecho, Ovsinnikov visitó España por vez primera en 1971, cuando participó en un simposio sobre antibióticos organizado por David Vázquez, que se celebró en Granada. Actualmente, Ovsinnikov es presidente de la Asociación Cultural Hispano-Soviética. Es para mí motivo de gran satisfacción que su visita coincida con mi estancia en Madrid, ya que ello me ofrece de nuevo la oportunidad de reanudar un cordial contacto iniciado hace 10 años con motivo de la conmemoración jubilar del 250 aniversario de la Academia Rusa de Ciencias, hoy Academia de Ciencias de la URSS, celebrada en Moscú y Leningrado. Yuri Ovsinnikov procede de un país que posee una añeja y distinguida tradición científica, la Academia Rusa de Ciencias, de la que el profesor Ovsinnikov es actualmente vicepresidente, fue fundada por Pedro el Grande en San Petersburgo en 1724 e inaugurada por su viuda Catalina I en 1725, trasladándose a Moscú en 1934. La Academia de Ciencias de la Unión Soviética es una de las más antiguas del mundo, precedida tan solo por una academia italiana fundada en 1560, por la Real Academia de Ciencias Matemáticas, fundada en 1575 por Felipe II en España, por la Real Sociedad de Londres, fundada en 1662, la Academia Francesa de Ciencias, fundada en 1669, y la Real Academia Sueca de Ciencias, fundada en 1710. Rusia ha tenido un químico de la talla de un Dmitri Ivanovich Mendeleev, genio creador de la tabla periódica de los elementos, que permitió predecir la existencia, confirmada ulteriormente, de elementos aún desconocidos, y fisiólogos de la estatura de Iván Petrovich Pavlov, universalmente conocido por sus trascendentales estudios sobre la fisiología de la digestión y los reflejos condicionados, galardonado con uno de los primeros premios Nobel. En el campo de la bioquímica, Rusia cuenta con figuras tan destacadas como Vladimir Alexandrovich Engelhardt, cuyo descubrimiento de la actividad contráctil del ATP sobre las fibras de miosina y sus pioneros estudios sobre la fosforilación oxidativa abrieron amplios cauces de ingreso a la moderna bioenergética, y la de Alexander Braunstein, descubridor de la transaminación, una reacción básica que permitió comprender los mecanismos fisiológicos de la oxidación desaminativa de los aminoácidos y la biogénesis del amoníaco urinario. No debemos olvidar aquí a Alexander Oparin, mundialmente conocido por sus pioneros estudios y sus teorías sobre... el origen de la vida. Entre los científicos soviéticos de generaciones más recientes, y ya en el campo de la biología molecular, destacan, entre otros, los nombres de Bayev y Spearing, por los estudios de ambos sobre ciertos componentes, los RNAs de transferencia y los ribosomas, de la compleja maquinaria que lleva a cabo la biosíntesis de las proteínas. La digresión con que encabezo mi introducción del profesor Ovsinnikov ha tenido por objeto poner en foco el ambiente científico de su país, que abre paso y encauza su distinguida trayectoria científica. Yuri Ovsinnikov nace en Moscú en 1934 y concluye su licenciatura en ciencias en la Universidad Lomonosov de Moscú en 1957. 1966 es el año de su graduación de doctor en ciencias químicas por la misma universidad. Ingresa en 1963 como investigador en el entonces Instituto de Estudios de Compuestos Naturales, más tarde el Instituto Shemiakin de Química Bioorgánica de la Academia de Ciencias de la URSS. Y en 1970 pasa a ocupar la dirección del mismo. Puede decirse que la línea directriz de la labor investigadora de Yuri Ovsyannikov es la búsqueda de la relación entre la estructura y la función de ciertas biomoléculas, fundamentalmente la de proteínas, bien dotadas de una función enzimática, como la aminotransferasa espártica, la RNA polimerasa, los factores de elongación de la cadena polipeptídica en la síntesis proteica, o que forman parte de la maquinaria translacional, proteínas ribosómicas, o proteínas fotorreceptoras de alta especificidad, como son las rodopsinas. Asimismo, Ovsyannikov ha investigado activamente la relación estructura-función de polipéptidos que influyen sobre el transporte de iones, sobre la ionoforesis, a través de la membrana celular. Entre ellos, las valinomicinas y ciertos venenos, tales como los de cobra y escorpión. En su esfuerzo por clarificar la correlación citada, Ovsyannikov y sus colaboradores han determinado la estructura primaria, es decir, la secuencia de aminoácidos de varias proteínas y algunos de los péptidos que acabo de mencionar, y han señalado la posible significación funcional de determinadas conformaciones moleculares, así como la estructura tridimensional de algunos grupos activos. En esta dirección se encamina también el clonaje molecular del gen de una encefalina, la leucinoencefalina, y la expresión de la misma en Escherichia coli, llevada a cabo hace unos años en su laboratorio. Desde 1972, el profesor Ovsyannikov dirige el Departamento de Química Bioorgánica de la Universidad de Moscú, y en 1973 se encargó también de la dirección del Instituto de Investigación de las Proteínas, situado en la ciudad de Pushino, no lejos de Moscú. Ovsyannikov ocupa altos cargos relacionados con la política científica de la Unión Soviética y es miembro de varias organizaciones internacionales como el Instituto Internacional de Energía y Ecología Humana y la Fundación CIBA para la Promoción de Cooperación Internacional en la Investigación Química y Médica, y es miembro del comité editorial de varias revistas científicas nacionales y extranjeras. Ovsyannikov es miembro de las Academias de Ciencias de Bulgaria, Checoslovaquia, la República Democrática Alemana y de la Academia Alemana de Ciencias Naturales, la Academia Leopoldina, y ha recibido numerosas distinciones nacionales y extranjeras que incluyen la Orden de Lenin y doctorados honoris causa por la Sorbona y por las universidades de Uppsala, Lima y Gdansk. Ovsyannikov ha viajado ayer de Moscú a Madrid y durante ese viaje ha tenido la noticia de ser el feliz padre de una nueva niña. Creo que todos debemos congratular al profesor Ovsyannikov por tan fausto motivo. Como ustedes saben, la información genética se expresa en dos etapas. La primera es la transcripción del mensaje genético contenido en el DNA con formación de RNA mensajero, el mRNA. En los organismos eucarióticos, la transcripción va seguida del procesamiento del RNA inicialmente formado para eliminar los intrones, secciones desprovistas de información genética, y unir los exones por el proceso conocido con el término inglés de splicing. En la segunda etapa, el mRNA, que ha pasado del núcleo al citoplasma, es traducido en este para formar proteínas, cuya secuencia de aminoácidos viene determinada por la secuencia de bases del mRNA, y confiere a las mismas propiedades específicas, características de cada una de ellas. La transcripción es catalizada por enzimas denominados RNA polimerasas, de las que en los organismos eucarióticos hay tres distintas, y se inicia en regiones del gen que poseen una elevada afinidad para la polimerasa. Se conoce a estas regiones con el nombre de promotores. Otras señales contenidas en el gen pueden modificar la velocidad de la transcripción, bien aumentándola o disminuyéndola. Se conoce a las últimas con el nombre de atenuadores. Finalmente, el gen contiene en su extremo terminal secuencias de bases que causan la terminación del proceso de transcripción. La conferencia del profesor Ovsínikov esta tarde versará sobre promotores de transcripción y la expresión de genes heterólogos. Soy muy feliz de nuevo de dar otra vez la bienvenida al profesor Ovsínikov y congratularlo por el nacimiento de su nueva hija, a quien deseo conocer dentro de unos años. Muchas gracias.
Professor Ochoa, Your Excellency, colleagues and friends, ladies and gentlemen, it's a great privilege to be here and to have Professor Ochoa as the chairman of this session. It's my privilege to talk in Juan March Foundation on the topic of modern biology. I would like to express my deep gratitude to the organizers of this meeting and to Juan March Foundation for a flattering invitation to this lecture. I hope that the understanding of problems of modern biology will facilitate the solution of problems of science, economy, and even politics. Even these thoughts, I came to Spain again, to this marvelous country, and I hope that this visit will promote the future collaboration between scientists of Spain and Soviet Union. Thank you very much. Today, I am going to discuss some problems connected with the function of the living cell. I have the feeling that the mainly chemical mechanisms are responsible for the functioning of the cell. The thousands of molecules, small and large, are appearing, interacting, and disappearing during the function of the cell. And to some extent, the living cell is a miniature chemical plant with well-organized, optimized, waste-free, automatically regulated production. The information in the living cell is based on the huge chemical structures, the structures of biopolymers. And among that biopolymers, I would like to mention the nucleic acids and proteins. Being the protein chemist, I was trying to solve the problems which I am dealing with on the basis of the relationship between structure and function of protein molecules. But it is difficult nowadays because genetic engineering and all machinery connected with the transformation of nucleic acids involved very rapidly in development of modern biology, and step by step we have to recognize that the most important, the principal molecule which is existing in the living cell, and we have to deal with this molecule in all the cases, is a DNA, a deoxyribonucleic acids. May I have a first slide, please? That's quite famous structure. Therefore, when we started to build up the new facilities of our institute, the Shemyakin Institute of Bioorganic Chemistry in Moscow, being the protein chemistry chemist, I selected the different shape, next slide, which is similar to DNA. This building is already ready. Some of my colleagues recently visited me in this institute. You are welcome, several in this new building, as well as any other in this audience. Okay, now if we are looking a little deeply in the living cell, may I have a next slide? That the information which is concentrating in DNA is step by step transferring to the proteins. The first step, when on the basis of DNA, the shorter RNA, shorter nucleic acid, so-called messenger RNA or information RNA synthesized, called transcription. And then on the basis of that transcription or messenger RNA, the proteins are printed in such printed presses called ribosomes. And to understand this machinery, we have to follow the fundamental pioneering work of Professor Ochoa and his collaborators. That translational step is important to understand how the information which is written in the structure of nucleic acids is transformed to the information written in the amino acid language, in the language of proteins. There are several very fundamental principles underlying this informational transfer. And first of all, I would like to mention genetic code. Next. So it's very basic dependence between the structure of DNA and the structure of proteins. Each three nucleotides in the DNA determining in very correct way the corresponding amino acid. And all these relations are summarized in genetic code. Next slide, which is shown on that table. When we started to attack this problem on the basis of bioorganic chemistry, the chemistry of proteins, we decided to start with the key enzyme. Next slide. Enzyme which is running along the DNA and the reading the genetic information. This is a transcription. And if we considering transcription site, transcription system and DNA, there are several different regions which are important to know to understand the problem. Promoter, to which this enzyme is going to be bound and recognize, then operator, and this is a kind of regulation site to stop or to promote further transcription. The structural gene, which is corresponds to the structure of the protein, and termination, because we have to stop transcription in the proper moment. Next slide. So all this work is essentially done by very big enzyme called polymerase, shown in the green color. And that polymerase, consisting of several subunits, this very complicated function, and that polymerase is running, is sliding along the DNA, and during this transcription, the RNA molecule is formed, and on the basis of RNA, on ribosomes, the proteins are synthesized. There, everything is occurring in the minutes. The polymerase is rather complicating, huge enzyme. And to understand the function of transcription and the mechanism of transcription, you have to start with the structure of polymerase. And in our institute, we decided to attack the structure of this protein, which has the following subunits composition. Next slide. So there are several huge beta and beta prime huge subunits with molecular weight about 150,000, and two types of small subunits, alpha and sigma. What is the role of each subunit? Of course, when we started this work, we decided to use a protein methodology, and we analyzed amino acid sequence of proteins, starting with the smallest, with the alpha subunit. Next slide. And in practically several months, we completed the structure of this alpha subunit with something like 300, a little more, amino acid residues. It's not a very complicating task, but when we came to the situation when we have to cleave the large subunits like beta and beta prime, that protein methodology is not functioning anymore. What we found, that the best approach, if you're running along traditional approaches, to make partial proteolysis, to get large fragments of these huge subunits, and then to deal with each fragment as a small protein. Next slide. And that most terrible work to get all these fragments was done by my wife, who in that time was my collaborator. Now he is doing different work. But nevertheless, we got all these fragments, and we got partial sequence of this protein. Fortunately, in that step, we were able to use genetic engineering, and we got the genes of beta and beta prime subunits, and using DNA sequencing technology elaborated by Sanger, Maxim, Gilbert, Mirzabekov, Sverdlov in our country, we were running very fast along the sequences of the genes, and we completed the structure of these subunits. Next slide, please. So this is the genes we isolated, which is responsible for these subunits, beta and beta prime. Next one. And this is the genes, not just to see, because it's more than 4,000 amino acid residues in all these beta and beta prime subunits, and of course you have more than 10,000 nucleotides. But nevertheless, I would like to mention that the data we got on the basis of structural analysis of proteins facilitated the analysis of the genes, because we found two mistakes in DNA sequence using our data on protein structure. Okay, we came to the structure of this huge subunits. Next slide, you're getting the same. This is the final part. But of course, the most important question is how this protein, the structure of which is already known, is functioning in the reading of information. Normal approach is to study structure-function relationship, but the enzyme is too large, and we don't know the conformation, the spatial structure of this compound. Therefore, we started in a very different way. We decided to use natural mutations. We analyze the set of natural, different natural polymerases, trying to understand what is the function of different amino acids, what is the function of different substitutions in this protein. Next slide. And these mutations, I would like to show you, we collected 8 mutants of this polymerase shown here. This is a rifamycin and streptolidogen-resistant mutations. And I am showing that mutations here and here. And this is a mutation in the corresponding DNA sequence. So by comparison of this data, we got some ideas about the importance of sigma and beta subunits, because all these mutations are mainly localized in beta subunit. And two parts of beta subunit where all these mutations localize, central part and N-terminal part, are close to each other. And therefore, mutation is usually arising in these regions. It was some idea, but not quite sufficient. Therefore, we decided to make some modifications, and first of all, to study interaction by photoaffinity labeling or by chemical modification of this molecule. Because you cannot select the proper amino acid among 4,000 residues. You have to find out what are amino acid residues which are somehow involved in the function of polymerase. In the case of such large protein, it's not a very simple question. The next slide. So we made some modification with different reagents. For instance, we in this case, we used adenosine trimethylphosphate, and made modification. And we found that one residue, one histidine residue, 1,116, is involved in the binding of this compound. It's somehow indication about the role of beta subunit in the transcription. Of course, this is not sufficient, and now already we are doing site-directed mutations in with this protein. But you have to start. You have to find out at least the regions where you have to deal with site-directed mutations. Otherwise, you have too many possibilities for such direct analysis. Okay. This is a one counterpart of this game. Enzyme running along the DNA. The second counterpart is promoter. And we started modification of different promoters. Coming to the E. coli, because we analyzed the E. coli enzyme, and I would like to mention that we completed the total structure of E. coli enzyme. The last subunit, sigma, was elucidated in the United States by Burgess, and now the whole structure of E. coli RNA polymerase is well known. Next slide, please. And here I am going to show you a so-called ideal promoter, which was formed by computer analysis of 150 different promoters which were found in E. coli. So by this average calculation, Scherer got the structure of this so-called consensus or ideal promoter, and we synthesized By chemical methods, we synthesize this ideal promoter and prove this ideal promoter in transcription using genetic engineering approach and recombinant DNAs. But to prove this whole idea, we selected not only this promoter, but one of the most strongest promoters from the T5 phage, so-called P25. And then we made some hybrids of these two promoters and tested all these five, or we got even 10 promoters in the interaction with polymerase. What we found, the ideal promoter is not the strongest one. It's universal promoter, which is functioning in all cases. But the one of the strongest promoter we got by modification of this ideal promoter. It means that we have to understand more precisely the structure-function relationship in the case of promoter. Promoter is usually consisting of 50, 60 nucleotides. So it's not sufficient. Then we decided to synthesize the fragment of the fragments of the promoter, and in that case we selected promoter, one of the stronger promoter from FD phage. Next slide, please. We synthesize different fragments of this FD promoter and analyze the function of each of these fragments in transcription and in interaction with enzyme. And what we found that two regions here in the area of 35 and in the area of minus 10, these two regions are extremely important for the binding and the functioning of this promoter. And if you synthesizing just the strand, just the stretch of the DNA, having completely, let us say, A sequence, and only in this position you have short sequences corresponding to this region of AFD promoter, even in this case, promoter is going to be very strong. So it means that we came to some idea about the structure-function relationship of these promoters, and on that basis, analyzing the interaction of these promoters with RNA polymerase, we came to the model, which I would like to show you very briefly. Next slide. So according to this model, first of all, the sigma subunit is interacting with the DNA. Sigma subunit, and if the elongation step is starting, then beta and beta prime subunits are going to be participate in this interaction, never alpha. And so the data we got until now on the basis of this studies of interaction between promoters and polymerase. So, and in that moment, the unwinding of DNA is taking place and the real transcription. Okay, that was our contribution to understanding of transcription in such simple case, particularly in E. coli. But nevertheless, we had the set of promoters, and we decided to utilize these promoters in genetic engineering, in practical application in biotechnology. Of course, to start this work, you have to synthesize genes. And we also synthesized several genes most interesting from the practical point of view. And we elaborated some methods for chemical synthesis of nucleotides, improving sometimes the famous well-known methods for synthesis of oligonucleotides. May I have a next slide? This is a model which I'm not going to show you. For instance, the cysteine residues in different beta and beta prime subunits are participating in interaction with DNA. Next slide. Mm-hmm. Okay, that synthetic genes we synthesize using chemical methods. Just showing you briefly, this is a enkephalin, and this is a bradykinin. famous peptide hormone, which is responsible for the pain in the brain or in other tissues. And this is a so-called delta sleep peptide, rather short peptide and rather short gene, and more prolonged sequences we synthesize on, by this method. Next, and this is one of the gene belonging to bacterial rhodopsin I'm going to discuss a little later. And this is a foot and mouth disease vaccine gene we trying to utilize in our practical work. Okay, next slide. The principle which we utilize for the synthesis of nucleotides, which is essentially a phosphotriester method, but using as condensing agent sulfonyl chlorides, aryl sulfonyl chlorides here, and methyl imidazole as a catalyst, we got very good results. And even better if you're using some nucleophile catalyst. May I have the next slide? For instance, these compounds we are using as catalyst, and by these approaches, we can, it was published quite recently, and you can synthesize very rapidly. For instance, 20 nucleotides in 2.5-3 hours. So it's a really very practical method. And by these approaches, we synthesize all these genes I am going to tell you. So then afterwards, we started the practical work concerning insulin. Insulin, of course, we started with the gene of proinsulin. Next slide. This is a, already practically half scientific, half industrial research, because we took the patent and we made now already industrial production of proinsulin and insulin in Soviet Union. So this is a famous proinsulin, the precursor of insulin. And you know that insulin is responsible for the level of the sugar in the blood. And diabetes is a serious disease now. To cure this disease, you need human insulin. And one of the, I think, best approaches to this is genetic engineering. You know that the insulin is already on the market. It was produced in the United States. And the same is true now in Soviet Union. So what we did, we synthesized the whole structural gene for proinsulin. So proinsulin is something like 85 amino acid residues. We synthesize large 300 nucleotides structural gene. Next slide. And this is the gene we synthesized. And then using our promoters, we got recombinant system for biotechnology production of proinsulin. Next slide. So this is the plasmid we constructed. We took, in this case, heterologous gene. We took beta galactosidase genes and fused to the gene of insulin, of proinsulin. And by this approach, we got the insulin. So transformation of proinsulin to insulin can either by enzymatic digestion or by this cyanogen bromide. Both methods are practically used. Okay, next slide. Again, we synthesize the gene for alpha-2 interferon, and I'm not going to discuss this work is published. And dealing with, of course, with some commercial problems already. But nevertheless, we synthesize the genes for that, and using our promoters, we got very good vector for production of interferon in industrial scale. May I have a next slide? So this is a, I am showing you one of the systems we used for this synthesis of, biosynthesis of interferon. I would like to say that the practical application of all these methods is functioning rather well. The strain we have of recombinant strain we have for production of interferon has capacity of practically 2 grams of interferon, of pure interferon, in 1 liter of the culture. It's extremely productive strain. As far as I know, it's a little better than Genentech system. But nevertheless, we're using now, and we have the patent from this, for this system. Okay. Of course, it would be very exciting to make some modification of this interferon. What we are doing now, we're making the hybrid interferons, gamma interferons plus part of alpha interferon, alpha N and gamma, and so on. Different combinations, and we got many active preparations. Of course, we're trying to use site-directed mutagenesis for these approaches, and site-directed mutagenesis, or protein engineering, as many people prefer say now. May I have a next slide? Is the following approach. So you have, for instance, the DNA, for instance, single strain phage. And from this single strain phage DNA, you can get double-stranded system applying or utilizing synthetic oligonucleotides with specific mutations you inserting here by chemical synthesis. Then after you're getting such normal system which resembling recombinant plasmid, you can get, after transformation and different procedures, you're getting the modified plasmid, and that plasmid is giving you the protein with mutations in that or that position. So with predetermined mutations. And that is a protein engineering which gives you possibility to change, to replace different amino acids in huge proteins. It's completely new situation and very enticing situation in protein chemistry now. What we did, we modified this procedure to give to make more maybe efficient system. We are never using the phage, but we're using the normal plasmid. May I have a next slide? For instance, if you have a recombinant plasmid with a gene you are talking about, with a gene you insert already in that plasmid, then you can split this plasmid by restriction enzyme here, and after action of endonucleases, exonucleases, you're getting these 2 strands with a part of the gene is still existing. You're shaving partially some sequences of DNA, but you're still getting this system. And then you are touching this oligonucleotide with mutation to this part of that system, and by application of polymerase, DNA polymerase and DNA ligase, you're getting normal plasmid with mutation. So this is a protein engineering in normal microbial plasmids. It's some advantage because usually you're dealing with plasmids in normal genetic engineering. So, and after transformation, screening, and you can, of course, separate these 2 plasmids using in hybridization techniques the same synthetic oligonucleotide, and you getting in rather high yield the recombinant and plasmid with localized mutations. And by these approaches, we're getting some proteins. Okay, technology or biotechnology, modern biotechnology, is ready to start or to face some problems. And in practical way, we can solve these problems, we can get rather with high efficiency the interferon, insulin, and different other regulators of human organisms. But what is the situation to face some basic problems, to face some fundamental problems, which is not easy to solve using traditional approaches? And to demonstrate this, I would like to discuss in the final part of my talk about the problem which we are working for a long time, and this is a problem connected with light-sensitive proteins. The family of proteins which are sensitive to the light. But I would like to discuss the following. May I have the next slide? First, the human eye. And in this membrane, the protein is localized, is known already 100 years, called rhodopsin. Rhodopsin is a protein which is localized, next slide, localized in the rods or in the cones. In this case, the proteins, rhodopsins, which are responsible for the color vision, colorful vision, red, green, blue, and this for black and white vision. And in these discs, in photosensitive discs, that protein is localized. More than 70% of these discs is essentially this rhodopsin. Rhodopsin has photosensitive retinal moiety, which is transforming the light to the some kind of energy, and that energy responsible for transformation of protein. In principle, everything is known, but what is difficult to know how this protein is functioning. And to start this, you have to start with the structural work again. Next slide. And we started this. We started this, but we didn't succeed. We didn't succeed in the isolation of this protein because it's a highly insoluble protein and so on. Discovery was made in United States, in Germany, by Stakenius and Oesterheld, facilitated this study. The discovery was made in 1971 when they found in some salt lakes, for instance, this is a part of the salt lakes in Israel, microorganisms, next slide, microorganism called Halobacterium halobium. And these microorganisms is moving in the water, in the salt water, along the salt gradient, and under specific conditions, this microorganism is utilizing the light. For instance, if the so-called shocking conditions are coming, after rain, when the concentration of salt is going down. In this case, very specific membranes called purple membranes, this is the patches of purple membranes, starting to function. And they are utilizing the light, helping this microorganism to survive. And surprisingly enough, the structure and function of this protein was pretty similar to the structure and function of protein in the human eye. And they called him bacteriorhodopsin. So we switched on our activity to that protein and started to work with that, because if you're working with a human eye, it's difficult to get appropriate amount of material. We started to work with bacterial rhodopsin, and you can collect a lot of material by fermentation. Next slide. What was shown in the meantime, that bacterial rhodopsin is localized in that purple membrane and functioning as a light-driven proton pump. This is a normal machinery, phosphorylative oxidation, and this is a light-sensitive machinery with bacterial rhodopsin. We started We collected material, we started structural work, and Henderson in Cambridge, in Great Britain, was able to show, may have next slide, that bacterial rhodopsin is spanning the membrane seven times, seven rods. This is an alpha helical rods, but the only such low resolution picture was available, because you can't crystallize this protein, and you're using two-dimension electron microscopy to get this information about the conformation of protein within the membrane. Practically, this is a membrane preparation. So that was a very nice support for our work, and we started structural work. When we got first results, I was giving the lecture in Skövde in Sweden on the Nobel Symposium on Biological Membranes, and suddenly, when I was talking about bacterial rhodopsin, I checked Professor Gobind Khurana in the audience, and I was quite surprised, because Professor Khurana is a famous geneticist and molecular biologist who was responsible for the discovery of genetic code and so on and so on. But why he is interesting in biological membranes and proteins? And I asked him, Professor Khurana, what you are doing here? And he told me that I am trying to make myself clear in membranes. And I didn't realize that whole group of Professor Khurana switched on to the membranes in that time, and I got very unpleasant competition in our work. And since that time, we are competing long time already. Next slide, but I think we have nice relationship. We completed the structure of bacterial rhodopsin using modern but traditional approach. Amino acid sequence determination. Khurana finished 2 months later, but he checked two errors we got in the sequence. So I think 50-50. So nevertheless, he made the further steps in that research, and he isolated the gene and the start of genetic engineering of bacterial rhodopsin, and we came to the same approaches a little later. Unfortunately, it was practically no possibility to get expression in the case of bacterial rhodopsin. These membrane proteins, they are unique. They have unique properties, and they are not transcribed, and they are not expressed in the E. coli system. So you have rather, I would like to say, symbolic yield during this biotechnology approaches, and therefore you have somehow to change that approach. So it was identical situation in both laboratories, and what we made some site-directed mutations in bacterial rhodopsin to understand how the system is functioning. Because the main question is, what is the function of that proton pump? May I have a next slide? We know, for instance, that topography of bacterial rhodopsin within the membrane is following. 7 rods, we know from Henderson, spanning the membrane. Then you can localize all these loops and all these sequences by monoclonal antibodies. Again, these white antibodies from Khurana and yellow from our laboratory. Again, competition. But by combination, we got complete topography of bacterial rhodopsin. Is not sufficient, because you have topography, you have practically conformation like in X-ray crystallography, but you have no idea about the function of this molecule. Next. This is a complete sequence of bacterial rhodopsin. Next slide. And this is a approach which we started to use in this case. We started to use normal chemical modification, because if you have low expression, You cannot apply site-directed mutation techniques. You're coming back to the old chemistry. And what we did, we modified all lysyl residues in that. Lysyls are a very good candidate to transfer protons. We put the methyl groups on all lysyls, and bacterial rhodopsin was as active as natural one. It means the lysyls are not participating in the proton pumping. Next slide, which I am showing on the next slide. Okay. Then we decided to use slightly different approach. Next, what we were able to show, then if you're shaving out the C-terminal region of bacterial rhodopsin, this is a 20 amino acid residues tail in C-terminal part. You're shaving by enzymatic digestion. And the membrane preparation is functioning with the same efficiency. It was shown in our collaboration with Professor Skulachev of Moscow University. It means that this part of bacterial rhodopsin is not very much important for the function of proton pump. And then we selected beta-galactosidase of E. coli, which we can express and get in the very high yield in transcription, and we got the hybrid between bacterial rhodopsin and beta-galactosidase. We put a beta-galactosidase instead of that tail in the C-terminal part of, and transcription was going marvelously after this modification. So you have to think about that. So it means even E. coli is filling its own protein or not. And you have to deal to play game with this filling. So therefore, in many cases, expression of heterologous genes is very important. Okay, by this case, we're making some mutations. Next, we are doing this now. This is just experience showing that C-terminal part is not essential for the function. Next slide. And this is a recombinant plasmid with a beta-galactosidase gene and fused bacterial rhodopsin gene, and this is a promoter and so on. We use different sets of promoters. Now we have, relatively good expression, and we are working on the site-directed mutations in the case of this protein. Next. And this is mutations we are doing now to substitute mainly tryptophan, tyrosine, on aspartic acid residues, because aspartic acid residues and tyrosines are very good candidate for participation in proton pumping. The another loop, next slide, please. Another loop is, next one. Next. This is a system of proton pumping of bacterial rhodopsin. We know practically everything about this protein, but still we have no idea what is the mechanism of proton pumping. We are coming to this problem using all methodology, all techniques, including modern genetic engineering and protein engineering. But it is not a very simple task. Okay, now back to the vision, to the human eye. Next. We have some experience, and we finished the structure of visual rhodopsin. Professor Karana got the grant in NIH for that, but we finished in that case 1 year earlier, and he canceled that grant. But another group in United States made fundamental and brilliant contribution to this area, and this is a Hognes group in California who isolated the gene of mammalian rhodopsin. And the genes, not only for black and white vision, but genes for colorful rhodopsins. And then when that work was published, we were following these techniques because the level of of mammalian genetics in Soviet Union is not very high, and you have to utilize the level of that genetic in the United States. So we did. And now we're working on the understanding of structure of this protein. May I have a next slide? So what this is a gene of rhodopsin, of mammalian rhodopsin. Unfortunately, the structure is much more complicating. You have four introns, which was shown by Hognes, four introns, and these introns complicating seriously your approaches. You can't apply synthetic methods and so on. But nevertheless, we are dealing with this problem. May I have the next slide? And so this is a structure of the structure of mammalian rhodopsin from the human eye. And we came to this topography using the same approach as in the case of bacterial rhodopsin, which is quite remarkable. Even that protein containing seven alpha helical rods, the seven is the holy number in Russian religion. And therefore, I think it's a great significance to support this. And nevertheless, the main problem is not the structure. Main problem, what residues are participating in the function. And the main function of this protein to start cascade of enzymatic reactions here after phosphorylation. The cascade of enzymatic reaction is starting here because the family of proteins is coming to this position, transducing GTP binding protein, and then phosphodiesterase. And what we are doing now, we isolated the family of genes of all these proteins and doing the structure and some site-directed mutations of this family, trying to understand how the system is functioning. It's important for understanding not only the function of proteins, but also for ability to care some disorders in vision. May I have a light? So I was trying to tell you some problems connected with the transfer of information from nucleic acid to proteins, and trying to show you how you can apply it or the modern genetic engineering and protein engineering to study some fundamental problems. But coming back to transcription, I would like to say that in the human organisms, where the genome structure is rather complicated, transcription is started every second, every minute, and different genes are switching on and functioning using some kind of the command, the signal coming from the nerve system. And to understand the molecular level of different genetic disorders and molecular level of different functions in the higher organisms, we have to start with rather simple cases to understand how transcription, how is taking place, how the nucleic acids fragment is functioning, how the protein is arranged in the space and in the proper cellular system, and how the system is functioning. And this is a very interesting interesting era in modern biology, approaching us to the more fundamental and interesting problems. Thank you very much for your attention.